This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
The Nunes memo has been released. What does it contain, and is it as big a deal as we were told and thought to believe? We'll answer those questions now on Tactics. Good morning, everybody. Welcome into Tactics. It is great to be with each and every one of you. I am Caleb Colquitt, for those of you who are unaware, and we are about to talk some politics, get into the news of the day. I know that with many of you, according to statistics that I've read about this, that there's a lot of you that actually aren't going into work this morning. Now, I don't know if you're listening to my show at home, or maybe you're coming in late right now, so you're just now driving into work. You decided to call in sick, but apparently this is the biggest sick day of the year because a lot of people stay up late and watch the Super Bowl, and so they either take the day off or take a sick day or whatever. Probably not nearly as many here in the state of Alabama as up north, because college football is the real primetime show here, but, you know, there's probably at least a few of you that took that. I don't know if you are within the sound of my voice or you're just at home, you know, just now waking up or something like that. But either way, if you're with us today, we appreciate you being with us this morning, however you choose to listen to us, right here on terrestrial radio or through iHeart or through the News Radio 1440 app. We give you plenty of options on how to listen to us. But anyway, I do want to get into this memo, which came out after my show on the weekend, and a lot of people are trying to say now that it was much ado about nothing. It really wasn't a dud. It's not as though this memo isn't important or contains some information that was unknown to us before, so there is new stuff in there, but it was not. I think the reason that a lot of people are kind of perceiving it that way is because there was so much fighting over it between the Republicans and the Democrats, and just absolutely going at each other's throats, accusing the other of hating this country and putting their own political careers ahead of the security of the country. And because there was so much made about this, and because it was built up to be so incredibly controversial, that because it was still controversial, still had new information, but it wasn't like the Watergate tapes, a lot of people were like, oh, it wasn't as big a deal as we were told to believe. I think that that's a fair assessment. But to say that they're unimportant or it was just a massive dud is not really accurate either. However, I think it's important for everybody to remember when going through this, and we are going to go through some of the content here in just a second. This is still a GOP memo. And this is something that I am certain the Democrats will in no way fail to remind us of over and over and over and over and over again, that this memo was produced by the Republicans. It's essentially their notes on an investigation. And because of that, you are looking at it through a partisan lens. That doesn't mean the information contained within it is inaccurate. It may be inaccurate, it may be accurate, it may be accurate but needs proper context. And the same thing could be said about the Democrat memo on the same investigation. You're going to be seeing some of the same information, but skewed through a partisan lens. And so now the Democrats are arguing, and this was their big thing this morning. They're going to be talking about it all week. They want their side of the story told. They want their memo out there, and they want that to be released. Honestly, I think that's fair. However, we don't need dueling memos. We don't need this side saying, well, this is what those papers said, and the other side saying, this is what those papers said. You know what makes all this go away and ends the debate immediately? Releasing the actual papers. Release the FISA warrant that this memo is, you know, that the original document that this particular memo was written about. Because then you're not looking through a lens. You're just looking at the raw data. And so I ask everybody involved when we were talking about this debate. Instead of worrying about whether the Republicans are accurate or the Democrats are accurate or saying you can't trust this memo but you can trust this one, we don't need all that. It's a waste of time. And so while this memo might shed light on some things, it's hard to absolutely say with certainty that this is something that needs to be looked at because, again, we're looking at it through a partisan lens. And maybe there is some things that were taken out of context. Maybe there's some information that is skewed a little bit to benefit the Republicans. That's a fair criticism to make of something that was produced by only one party. And so we really need all the documents out on the table so we can take a look at them. And the person that can do that is President Donald Trump. I don't know if he will or not. But if Donald Trump wanted to show himself to be not a partisan guy and a friend of the people, which is something that he has been doing over the past couple weeks, been trying to reach out to the Democrats, trying to paint himself as someone who's not uber partisan. Now, I don't necessarily agree with some of the things that he's done in the name of that. But if that is the aura he wants to project to the American people, I think, for one, his State of the Union went a long way in doing that, because even though I didn't like a lot of the policy things that he brought up, studies of the State of the Union showed that even 42% of Democrats, and I believe it was 70, a little north of 70% of independents, thought that the State of the Union was a really great speech, even though the Democrats in leadership, you know, sat down, didn't applaud, all that stuff. The actual Democrat voters that watched the speech, almost half of them said it was a good speech. And so if Donald Trump wants to continue down this road of trying to present himself as somebody for the people and not necessarily for one side or the other, one thing that he could do to really put that message forward is to declassify these underlying documents. He has the ability to do that. He can put the FISA warrant out if he wants to. That's one of the president's powers of the executive. So I think that would be a tremendous step in the right direction for Donald Trump. It would not only put out this message of being bipartisan that he's trying to put out there, but more importantly, and from my own perspective, it gives us the raw information so that we can make decisions for ourselves, which that's why we're supposed to have transparency in government, so we're not getting all our information from one party or the other or having these combating messages, because the American people can look at the documents themselves and make their own decisions. That's why government should be as transparent as possible, so we don't have to look through that lens. Now, this particular memo starts with a FISA warrant into the Trump campaign, the Trump campaign's volunteer, Carter Page. And we're going to get into who Carter Page is. We're going to get into why all this is important, the information. We're getting there in just a minute. We're going to go to a break right now. If you want to weigh in, 860-1440. If you have any questions, you can ask those. I'll try to get to them as quickly as possible. We will be back in just a minute.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The Bible is the best of all books, for it is the Word of God and teaches us the way to be happy in this world and in the next. Continue, therefore, to read it and to regulate your life by its precepts. John Jay, First Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440. And newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. You can also tweet us at Tactics Radio. I don't know why, but I had my mind slipped there for just a second. I almost said you can tweet us at Patriot Preach. So haven't been the Patriot Preacher in several months now. I guess I just slipped up there. But Tactics Radio at Tactics Radio is the way to get in touch with us over Twitter. So this memo that was released on Friday becomes a big news dump. I'm actually kind of surprised they released it on Friday, because the whole point of this memo was to get people's attention, and the Trump administration released it on the day that you usually release bad news that you don't want people to see. So not really sure exactly why they did that. I honestly expected them to release it, but release it on like a Monday morning. But no, they released it on Friday, so I don't know. Maybe there was some strategy involved in that. I'm really not sure. But the memo starts going through the content here with a FISA warrant into Trump campaign volunteer Carter Page. Now, to give you a little bit of background in Carter Page, he's somebody that the intelligence community kind of sees as, honestly, a little bit of a dope. And he's someone that they don't necessarily see as being the brightest light bulb in the house. And so when he goes off and goes to Moscow and then winds up going into the Trump campaign as a volunteer, they start suspecting that because, you know, Russia has a tendency and a history of trying to get people into powerful positions and having influence over our politics through that. We saw that with the Hillary Clinton thing. They tried to insert one of their agents into the Clinton campaign to get information out and to have some influence in there. Somebody that worked her way into the Clinton campaign and tried to work her way up the ladder and get as much information to the Russians as possible. We saw them do this. So this would not be a strategy that would be far-fetched to assume that Russia would be interested in actually doing. So with that in mind and with that context, and with them already knowing that Carter Page is kind of seen in the intelligence community as this gullible guy who they know and have had, you know, had to do work with before, you know, investigate what he's up to. That's something that you need to keep into consideration when asking why they would have issued a FISA warrant on this guy. And he did go to Moscow back in 2016 and apparently had information that he had met with very high-ranking officials in the Kremlin, that kind of thing. Doesn't mean that they were planning anything or that he's an agent of Russia, but it is suspicious that he does that and then immediately goes into as being a volunteer advisor to the Trump campaign. And then you've also got Chris Steele, who is this British IM6 agent and someone who has been considered a very reliable source for us in the past, that he's given us information that's checked out many, many times. And the intelligence agency also knows that. They know who Chris Steele is. And with that being said, they go to try to get a warrant on this guy, Carter Page, to survey him and see if he's sending information back to Russia or anything like that. And they're getting information from Steele that Carter Page might have been involved in this. He's the one that kind of started this whole thing. And so what they do is they start talking and they might go to the FISA court and tell the judge, okay, this guy who you know, Carter Page, you know, there's reasonable suspicion that he might be involved in something with the Russians. Oh, and also we're getting this information from Chris Steele, who's somebody who's been a very reliable source of information for us in the past. And so the judge probably knows both of these people, as the intelligence community does as well. And so with all that evidence stacking up, it is not hard to understand why the judge might say, yeah, let's go ahead and issue a warrant. Because Steele's information's been correct. This guy, Carter Page, we don't know what's going on with him. We don't know why he went to Moscow. We don't have a lot of that information. And so, yeah, go ahead. Start listening in on his phone calls, that kind of thing. Here's the thing, though. According to this memo, nobody, when that procedure was going on, nobody mentioned that the dossier was assembled by DC, the DNC and Hillary. So the Clinton campaign that's putting together this dossier, that's paying for this research to be done, paying Chris Steele to put this together, it's at some point been funded by the DNC, the Clinton campaign, one of Donald Trump's Republican rivals, which dropped it and then it was picked up later by the DNC and Clinton. We still don't know who that rival is. And the Russians, because they're involved with Fusion GPS. But nobody, according to this memo, mentions that to the judge. So if you're looking at the information that the judge would have been presented with, let's just assume that he's a good stand-up guy. He's not a partisan. He doesn't care whether or not Carter Page works for the Trump campaign or the Clinton campaign. He just sees it as being suspicious. Let's just assume for a second and play that scenario out in our head that the guy really is just a patriot and he's wanting to get to the bottom of this. Well, if none of that stuff is mentioned, which this memo alleges wasn't mentioned to the judge, and all he knows is the stuff that it was given to him by Chris Steele and it's about Carter Page, frankly, I don't blame the judge for issuing a warrant. Now, I don't like the idea of FISA courts altogether, and so I don't even like the idea of there being this process by which you can sort of skate past the Fourth Amendment, but we'll get into that in a little bit later. My point in all this is, can you really blame the judge at that point for doing that? And I think this was the whole point of the Republican memo. If I'm looking at that data, I don't blame the judge. I blame the people giving the judge the information, who are giving specifics that make the information look credible and aren't giving him the reasons why maybe the information might be a little skewed. And when I mean a little skewed, I'm talking about, oh, by the way, all this information that we're giving you that we're trying to say this is the reason we need to investigate this was funded by Donald Trump's political enemies. Well, that's a very good reason to think that this dossier would have been compiled in such a way to look as bad as possible, because that's what opposition research is. You're doing research to make the person look bad. You're trying to dig up dirt. That's the whole purpose of opposition research. And when you do gather that information, you're going to skew it in whatever way is favorable to you. So they wanted this info to help the Clinton campaign when they assembled it. And this was used as a basis for issuing a warrant on an advisor in Trump's campaign? That's incredibly problematic. Because the thought is, possibly, that the people in the FBI that were putting this together were doing so just so they could get information on Donald Trump and what his campaign was doing, so that they could counterpunch, have an inside look. It would be like if you're in a baseball game, you have a bug in the opposite team's dugout. Or a football game, you've got a bug in the head coach's headpiece for his communication, so you know what plays they're going to run. You can see how that would be incredibly problematic. Also, this dossier further attacks Chris Steele's credibility. So according to this, he was taking money from the other side. That's what, you know, comprises this dossier. We already knew that. But it also says that Steele met with Yahoo News about Carter Page and then lied about it to authorities. And that's important because there's a confidentiality agreement that takes place when informants give information to the FBI. So he was expected and knew this ahead of time, that he was expected to stay away from the media and keep all his information to himself, but apparently he went to Yahoo News, and interestingly enough, this warrant cites Yahoo News as a separate source, even though we now know that Yahoo News' original source was Chris Steele. So if that's the case, then that means there's really only one source that was given as evidence for the FISA warrant, because those two different sources came from the same place. And according to the FBI's interviews with Bruce Orr, who knew Steele, Steele was, quote, desperate that Donald Trump not get elected and was passionate about him not being the president. That alone ought to give you suspicion as to his motives and why he was putting together this dossier and informing the FBI about it. Again, it's a GOP memo. Don't know how accurate it is, but if this is true, that's incredibly problematic. Take it right.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Colossians 3:17. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440. And NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. Also, you can tweet us at Tactics Radio if you want to get in on this. Now, going through this memo that came out on Friday, it's important to get all the facts, all the information out there. And so I'm going to do the best that I can to give you a summary and kind of what it means and what are the ramifications of said memo. So we're going to go into what it says about the Steele dossier. We all know this dossier. It was the one that came out and it caused a big stir and kerfuffle, originally published in BuzzFeed and then later not published but referenced by CNN. And this is actually one of the big things that started, well, not started, but certainly one of the biggest contributing factors to Donald Trump and his war with CNN. Because he already wasn't really a big fan of CNN, but after this was put out, he had a he kind of pitched a fit about it, which there's been several times where I have also been critical of CNN, and at times, specifically because they had a bias against President Trump. But in this particular situation, I don't think that they mishandled this information when it did come out. They handled it responsibly. They didn't talk about the salacious details, but here's the issue, and this is why this dossier can't be trusted. We knew, and this is what CNN reported the day that it came to the public's attention, when this Steele dossier came out, that some of the stuff in it is accurate, some of the stuff in it doesn't check out. Some of the stuff in it we know to be false. And the most salacious thing, and I hate to even talk about this on the air, but this is to give you an idea of how far-fetched and ridiculous some of the stuff in this dossier are. One of the allegations was that Donald Trump went to a hotel and hired Russian prostitutes to urinate on him and the bed. And where that all comes apart, because you could see Donald Trump maybe being into some weird stuff. We already have talked about the allegations that he had had an affair with a porn star. And I mean, he was kind of known for and bragged about, talked about and admitted himself that he had been with lots of women, that he had cheated on his wife. Here's where that all falls apart, though, with this thing specifically. Donald Trump is a notorious germaphobe. He doesn't even like shaking hands with people. And you're trying to convince me that he is up for engaging in that with Russian prostitutes? And so a lot of that information in the dossier has been proven to be flat out wrong. And that one, which makes no sense whatsoever. So this is already not a trustworthy document, and we should expect nothing different considering the source, considering that it was funded by people that specifically had a vested interest in making Donald Trump look as bad as possible. But the thing is, if that's how all this came together, it should not have never been used as a means to get a warrant on somebody. And so it appears as though, according to this memo, that the Steele dossier was a driving force behind the Carter Page FISA warrant. Now, Deputy Director Andrew McCabe testified that there would be no surveillance warrant without it. So in his testimony, he said, without this dossier, the warrant doesn't happen. That's where this originated from. And, of course, Andrew McCabe no longer there. He resigned recently right before the memo came out. It's possible, because he's mentioned several times in this memo, and it's hardly flattering to him, that maybe that was part of it. We're really not sure. But it talks about his testimony that if that dossier doesn't come into contact with the FBI, no warrant ever happens. And, by the way, he also is one of the people that signed one of the warrants in behalf of the FBI. There were four warrants, because there was the original, and then there were three follow-ups, because you have to renew that warrant every 90 days to continue surveillance on somebody who's an American citizen. And so on behalf of the FBI, Director James Comey signed three of them. Andrew McCabe signed the fourth. You can see why that would paint them in a very bad way. Because the American people, I think, should be rightfully outraged that we have the FBI getting involved in this and signing warrants on American citizens based on information that they know may or may not be credible. That should upset everybody, regardless of what side of the political aisle that they happen to fall on. And James Comey briefed President Trump and told him that the dossier was, quote, scandalous and unverified in June 2017. And yet, like I just said, he signed three of the four FISA warrants on Carter Page. And this is what's so problematic to me. This is what troubles me. Because Comey has been such a political football. Because at one point, the Democrats hated him and the Republicans loved him. And then the Republicans loved him and the Democrats hated him. And back and forth and back and forth two or three times. And so it was hard for me, and I think it was hard for a lot of people that were really thinking about this and to wrap their head around, is Comey just trying to do his job, or is he playing for one team or the other? Because it seemed to go back and forth. Both sides either loved him or hated him. And so it was really hard to tell if he was just a good FBI agent doing the best that he could, or that he was maybe doing like we see some referees do on the football field. You make a call and then you look back on it's like, yeah, that was the wrong call. And then you try to do a makeup call with the next penalty. We see that happen sometimes. Maybe that was what was going on. But with James Comey, if he's telling President Trump in June 2017 that this dossier is salacious and unverified, in other words, explaining to him, Mr. President, we're just telling you that we have this. We don't believe it. It's salacious. But this is the information that other people have on you. He's not saying that he believes that it's true. He's saying that this is what is going around. However, and this is important, if James Comey knew that it was salacious and unverified and still signed three of the FISA warrants, that he knows the origin of those warrants and the reason that those warrants are being issued on Carter Page came from the Steele dossier, then what happened? He didn't get new information. The dossier wasn't updated at that point. So he either signed those warrants knowing full well that they were based on something that may or may not be true, and were salacious and were assembled by Donald Trump's political opponents, or he was just saying that to tickle the president's ears. And based on this memo, it seems far more likely that it's the first option. That Comey knew that this dossier was problematic and yet signed three of the four warrants. That is a big deal. Because it proves that the FBI was willing to put an American citizen under surveillance by hiding information and giving some information but not giving all of the facts to the judge so that he can make a decision, because they just wanted an in on the Trump campaign. If that is the case, we've got to do some serious cleaning up at the FBI. And I think that the average American, even those who tend to lean Democrat right now, they know something's up in the FBI with the leadership. Not necessarily the rank and file guys, but there's some leadership in the FBI that's up to some suspicious activity. And I think that the Democrats really felt this with the whole Hillary investigation and the way that it was kind of tossed around, and Republicans really are seeing it now. However, there is one last section in this memo. The Page FISA application, so the application to get that FISA warrant, mentions a guy named George Papadopoulos. For those of you who don't remember, George Papadopoulos was a guy who worked for the Trump campaign that it turns out was actually working with the Russians. Now, it doesn't look like he actually did anything illegal. He was just trying to get information. He was trying to get information on the Clintons to help the Trump campaign, and he talked about coordination, but it never actually happened. Still shouldn't have done it. Still a big deal. Still shows that there were at least a person or two in the Trump campaign that was okay with working with Russia. But, you know, since then they've distanced themselves from him. They never actually went through with it, so far as we can tell. He had this plan to work together with the Kremlin, and pretty much everybody around the table said, no, bad idea, and dismissed it, and that was the end of it. But the point is, it does mention Papadopoulos. And this last section, this little, I think it's because they're numbered throughout this thing, number five in this section, talks about Papadopoulos. And this appears as though this pokes a giant hole in one of the Republicans' theories. Because we've talked a lot about this in the first couple pages of this memo lead you to believe that absolutely everything in this Trump investigation came from that Steele dossier. However, one thing that is mentioned in this last little section is that Papadopoulos was already under investigation before the Steele dossier was in the possession of the FBI. So they already had their eye on Papadopoulos. And they already suspected that the Russians might be involved in the Trump campaign before they got Chris Steele's information. So it appears as though, even though the Steele dossier was instrumental, and according to Deputy Director McCabe, Carter Page would not have been placed under a FISA warrant had it not been for that dossier. Still, the FBI was already investigating the Trump campaign for collusion with the Russians before they had that dossier through Papadopoulos. So that is one thing that either the Republicans, you can look at this a couple ways. Either the Republicans writing this memo were incredibly honest, and even though they had a feeling this was going to poke a hole in a lot of the conspiracy theories that people who tend to lean more towards them have been having, they published it anyway because it was the right thing to do. I hope that is why they included this in the memo. I don't know that, but I really hope that that was the motivation. Another possible theory is they didn't realize that they were basically admitting that Papadopoulos was under investigation before the Steele dossier came out. I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems to me like a really egregious oversight if that were the case. So I'm hoping that the reason they included this last little section is not necessarily because they wanted to spill the beans on it, but to say they were also investigating Papadopoulos, and by the way, that was going on and taking place before the Steele dossier, and so they included it as a detail to make a point, but also did not shy away from saying that not absolutely everything in this investigation comes from that Steele dossier, even though that is still incredibly problematic with everything else they did with the dossier. That particular part actually started beforehand. So I hope that that is the case. Now, also it mentions Peter Strzok, which you may remember him. He was the guy that was sending all those text messages to Lisa Page, and the one that was saying that they needed an insurance policy against Trump, that kind of thing. All these, he was kicked off of the Mueller investigation because he had an anti-Trump bias. Peter Strzok was apparently the origin of the Papadopoulos investigation. And so here's the thing. Do you look at that and say, well, yeah, but Papadopoulos was so partisan that he was actually kicked off the Mueller investigation? Or do you look at that and say, well, yeah, he did start that investigation and maybe he had anti-Trump leanings, maybe he didn't. But we now know, in hindsight, that Papadopoulos was working with the Russians. So whether he had an anti-Trump bias or not, he was right. He did his job as an FBI agent looking into that matter. So that's kind of what makes this so sticky, because if Papadopoulos had not been found guilty, there was no evidence he'd been working with the Russians, that's a little different, because then you can say that Strzok is just this partisan hack that hated Trump and was doing that. But the truth is he was working with the Russians, so apparently he had a pretty good reason for investigating Papadopoulos. Now, I'm not saying that that excuses the text messages or that he should be put back on the Mueller investigation, anything like that, because I think it would be best if he just abstained from dealing with anything that has anything to do with Donald Trump from here on out based on that. However, Strzok and the FBI were right on that one. And so they had a good reason for investigating Papadopoulos. So I'm going to give a quick summary of this, some of the takeaways, some of the big ideas that you really need to know about this, and we'll discuss that in just a minute when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The name of the Lord, says the scripture, is a strong tower. Thither the righteous flee and are safe. Let us secure his favor, and he will lead us through the journey of this life and, at length, receive us to a better. Samuel Adams.
Hey everybody. Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. You can get in touch with us also by tweeting us at Tactics Radio. And speaking of calls, we do have Cooper on line one. Good morning, Cooper.
Good morning.
Yes, sir. What's on your mind?
Well, tell me if I've misunderstood this. As far as Papadopoulos is concerned, from what I understood, there was absolutely nothing illegal or wrong with what he did. It was just the fact that when he was sitting in a room with a couple of FBI agents, he panicked or whatever and lied about it and said
right.
he didn't do it.
Well, and that's what's problematic, because apparently this is the issue that you come into, because what Papadopoulos did was wrong and it was dumb. But
you're talking about the lie.
No, I'm actually talking about getting involved with the Russians. But no collusion ever actually came from it, because according to the story that we've heard from law enforcement officials, he came out and suggested it to the Trump campaign, but everybody in the room was like, yeah, that's a bad idea, and that was the end of it. And so he got flustered about it, like you said, lied about it to some people that were interrogating him, and that's what really got him in trouble.
I understand that. So that's why I don't quite understand. You were saying that, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, Strzok or...
yeah, I have problems with pronouncing his name, too. I think it's Strzok, Peter Strzok.
Well, you were saying he's just doing his job.
Right. Well, he had suspicion that this guy was talking to the Russians, and it turns out he was right. He was talking to the Russians. Nothing ever came of it.
What did he talk to the Russians about?
He was talking about getting information from them to help the Trump campaign that would have hurt the Clintons.
And
which he shouldn't have done. I mean, nothing. It's kind of like this. A policeman is doing his job by checking people going past him on the freeway and checking their speed. Now, that's doing his job. If he busts somebody that's not actually speeding, then he's going beyond the parameters of the job that we've given him to do. But just checking the speed, that's actually something he's supposed to be doing. So as far as I'm concerned, Strzok was actually doing the right thing by checking this out when he found out, okay, maybe this guy who is in the Trump campaign is talking to the Russians. But, you know, like you said, like was mentioned before, nothing ever actually came from it, but then he lied about it, and that's what actually got him in trouble.
Well, it seems to me that's what they're getting everybody about, these technicalities. Nobody's done anything that's illegal other than deny it to the FBI.
And that's why, and thank you so much for your call, Cooper. I appreciate it. That's why you always tell the truth. Because even if you're not doing anything wrong, if you lie about it just because you think it'll make you look bad, that's how you get yourself in trouble. And if you did actually do something wrong, then you get in more trouble. So that's why honesty is always the best policy. Thank you for your call, Cooper. I appreciate it. So I'm going to give you really quickly before we go to our top of the hour break. I'm going to give you really what were my big takeaways from this, the information that we got. Because like I said, there wasn't very much information that we got that was new per se, because it was information that we couldn't confirm, but it was all stuff that we had suspected for a really long time, most of it. And so these are my big takeaways. Number one, all the partisan bickering was just that, partisan bickering. This was talked about as though this was going to be the biggest deal ever. And, I mean, there was new information in it. It's going to change the perception of how people view the Mueller investigation and that kind of thing. But it wasn't this massive bombshell that was going to destroy American politics as we know it. So that was way overplayed. Second, if true, and keep in mind, we don't know for a fact that all of this is true, but if true, some people in the FBI are dirty and on the Democrat side. They're playing sides. Now, again, we don't have all the underlying information, and that might change the perception. But if that is the case, that's very serious, and it's obvious why we need to look into that further. Number three, the FISA court can be easily abused, which is why they should not exist. This has been my problem with FISA courts from the beginning. You need to get an actual warrant and go through a real court when dealing with American citizens. Number four, there was an obvious anti-Trump bias by several parties involved, including Strzok and Steele, and potential anti-Trump bias, maybe it was there, maybe it wasn't, in people like Comey and McCabe. certainly appears that way. And finally, not every aspect of the Russia investigation stems from the Steele dossier, but it was a major contributing factor, and it shouldn't have been because of where it came from. So those are my five big points that came out of this dossier. Hour two coming up.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Of course, the game was last night and had some really interesting plays, but I find the ads more fascinating. We go there now on Tactics. That's right, Manic Monday, after Super Bowl Sunday, and we are going to talk about that. I actually was just tweeting this out. David French, who is a political commentator, I'm sure a lot of you know him. He's very active on Twitter. I think he writes for National Review, had several articles in there. He's kind of he does a lot of things, but he was asking this question, which I thought was important. He said, you see public Christianity in lots of sports, but it seems especially prominent in football. I've got my own theory as to why, but I'd love to hear what others think. And so I responded to him. I said, if I was getting hit by a 350-pound linebacker every 45 seconds, I'd be praying a lot too, which I think is fair. I mean, you got to face that. I would be praying a lot that I wouldn't die playing the game, but nonetheless. I do think that with everything that's going on, I've always been fascinated by advertisements. And so, to be honest, I care about the commercials way more than the game. I don't hate the game. I don't have anything against people who like the game or get into it. That's fine. It doesn't bother me. I like college football. I like baseball. The NFL is just really not my thing. And so I didn't watch the game, didn't really want to watch the game. I was going to go to a Super Bowl party, but I, wound up not being able to make it. So I'm not against the game being on, and I don't, make a protest. It always bothered me when people would go out of their way to, make fun of an event because they're not into it. I don't really, for example, people did it with the big opening of Star Wars and different events that go on in the country, and they go out of their way to let people know that they don't care. Which, it doesn't bother me that you don't care. Just because I may be involved in something because I'm really excited about something and I know that there are people out there that aren't, that doesn't bother me. And so I kind of hope people extend the same courtesy to me as well, but I don't try to rub it in people's faces. I'm like, yeah, I don't really care for watching the game, but I'm not going to make this massive point about it and go out of my way to say, I don't watch the game and I don't care about it and it's stupid. I don't do that. I don't think it's productive to do it. I don't know why people do it. It never made sense to me, but I do care about the ads because as somebody who's in broadcasting, I've always been fascinated by advertisement, and the Super Bowl definitely is the cream of the crop. That's the best ads. They save them up all year and make a big deal about it because it is so incredibly expensive to get a Super Bowl ad on. And so I may not have watched the game, but I did watch all of the commercials on YouTube. Which is kind of a weird thing. But I let the Sports Radio 740 guys, I let them handle all the play-by-play. If you wanted to hear about that and hear about what's going on, you listen to John and Barry or the Jocks Roundtable or Joe Hunk over on Sports Radio 740. If you want commentary on the ads, you come here to News Radio 1440 just because I'm so fascinated by them. So the ads are on YouTube, and I wanted to go ahead and give you kind of a breakdown of some of them. Just for fun, just as something different to do. I thought that the best funny ads were, I think the best ad of the night, honestly, was the NFL ad where they scored a touchdown and they started dancing a little bit in the end zone. And then that kind of escalated and kept going until eventually they've got Time of My Life playing and they're doing like ballroom dancing in the end zone. In case you didn't see it, go watch that ad. It's really, really funny. It goes on for like a minute and a half. and it is just absolutely hysterical. At one point, they're joined by other football players, and there's line dancing going on. It's just hilarious. I think that might have gotten called for excessive celebration. I'm not sure, but I think that might get you a penalty flag. But anyway, really funny stuff. I thought that was good. The Australia ad for the tourism board, the Australian tourism board, that it made you think there was going to be a new Crocodile Dundee movie, and it turns out it's just an ad to advertise traveling to Australia. That was hysterical. The fact that it looked so much like a real movie, and then it turns out it's just an ad for vacationing in Australia. I thought that was incredibly clever, because that's one of the things that they're really known for. I mean, for goodness sake, in that song, Down Under, they actually say the land of Dundee. So I guess maybe he's a bigger celebrity in Australia than we give him credit for here. I'm really not sure. But that's their thing. So that's they made that ad about it. And let's see, what other were the best funny ads? The Bud Knight, that was really good. Where they're on the battlefield and the Bud Knight comes in, he goes and he grabs a, rides right past the battle, grabs a thing of Bud Light, and they ask, "Hey, are you going to you gonna stay and fight?" And then of course he winds up taking down the entire army, even though he was originally just gonna go in and get some Bud Light. I thought it was funny. Maybe the Bud Light people are riding this Dilly Dilly thing a little too far, but personally, I love the ad campaign. I love the Dilly Dilly ads. Think they're hysterical. So, you know, it wasn't necessarily the most original because they were working with a premise that already works. They love the Dilly Dilly thing that they've been doing because it got so popular. But look, if it's not broke, don't fix it. And so debuting a new ad in that series, I thought the Super Bowl was a perfect way to do that. And, of course, Budweiser is a big Super Bowl advertiser anyway. Let's see what else. The Ram commercial with the Vikings. That was really funny. How they've got the they've essentially trick out the Ram with all the shields on the side like a Viking boat, and then they're hauling the Viking boat with the truck, and then they're hauling the truck with the boat, and eventually they get to Minnesota. Really clever ad. I thought that was well done. And it may just be, honestly, I may be biased on that one. And the reason is I really like Ram trucks. That's what I drive. And I really like Vikings. And so there may be a little bit of bias there on my part. I'm not sure. And they had the Tide ads, which the first one they did that kind of explained the whole thing, where they were going to be taking other ads that you would normally see, ads for movies and ads for different things, basically replacing it to make you think it's an ad, but it's really a Tide ad because there's no stains on any of the shirts, and basically using that to say that all the ads are Tide ads because you're not going to see an ad where there's stains. And so it's not a bad idea, but I didn't think it was as funny as a lot of people did. The one that I did think was funny is when they did that spoof off of the Old Spice ad where they have the really muscular, handsome black guy riding on the horse. And it looks like it's going to be another stereotypical Old Spice ad. Turns out it's actually a Tide ad. And they were kind of spoofing that. That I thought was really clever. The other ones, I didn't think the Tide ads were all that funny. And I wanted to get to this because I think that this is important as well. And we do have a caller on the line, so we're going to get your calls. And I do want to, for the remainder of the show, even if we wind up changing topics, which we'll probably do at least in a segment or two, if you have a best and a worst Super Bowl ad, feel free to call in on that, give your thoughts. I'll be happy to take your calls, and you can even talk about something else. But, you know, if you can, give me your best and your worst Super Bowl ad if you happen to catch the game last night. There were a couple of serious ads that I thought were really good. There was one that was by Budweiser, where it's this factory worker, and he goes into work, and they shut down production of Budweiser so that they can start the production of, you know, use their canning facility to can water. And they went out to Texas, Florida, and Puerto Rico earlier this year bringing water to people. That was a great ad. And I love that ad because it shows a couple of things. First of all, it shows the unity of Americans. It doesn't matter who you are or where you live. If you're in trouble, Americans will show up to help their neighbors. It's part of who we are as a country. It's who we've always been. It goes back to the very foundation of our country. That's who the Minutemen were, the people that started the Revolutionary War. They saw the Redcoats going through their town and messing with their people, and they were afraid because that's what the Redcoats did, is they went in and took over a town, and they're going into to Lexington and Concord, and these people, just local people, get together and they're like, no, this is a problem in our town. We're handling this. We're going to stand up for our neighbors. So, I mean, that just goes back to the very identity of who we are as a country. And I love that ad because of that. That it's just regular Americans, not rich people that are giving millions of dollars and just throwing money at a problem. No, regular blue-collar type Americans going out and volunteering their time in a company who... It's a big company, and I know big companies get terrible reputations because of, in many ways, what the left tries to do to disparage capitalism, but that's another example, which there were several of them when the hurricanes hit, of big companies that have a lot of money taking time and profit and putting that aside for a second because their neighbors are in trouble, and it's time to help. So I love that ad. I thought it was a great ad. Although I have to say it was the second best serious ad. I thought that probably the best one was the Ram Truck ad, which I've given Ram Trucks a lot of praise for their Super Bowl ads. I really love that Paul Harvey when they did a couple years ago with the God Made a Farmer speech. That was just phenomenal. But they gave another one that I thought was really good and probably the best serious ad of the night. The MLK speech, where it was talking about how people were called to serve, kind of goes along the same lines of the Budweiser ad, interestingly enough. But the whole point of it was, you don't have to be a millionaire or somebody that's incredibly talented or somebody that has, you know, 15 different degrees, high education. And that was the point that King was making, is that everybody can serve their fellow man. And not only can everybody do so, but that's what the Bible commands us to do. It kind of goes back to a quote by Benjamin Franklin, and it reminded me of that, to where someone was asking him about what is our religion? What is our religion as a nation? Because you have to keep in mind, America was very unique. We were the only country that didn't have an official religion. The Anglicans, that was the Church of England. You had other countries that had their official state church, like Rome and Spain with the Catholics. America didn't have that. And so there was this person that was asking Ben Franklin, what is our national religion? And Ben Franklin, not the most religious of the founders, a religious guy before he died, but not someone that was uber religious like a lot of the other founders we talk about, like Jefferson and Washington and so on and so forth. But Franklin answers this way, and I thought it was just such a good answer that hit the nail on the head. He said, love God, serve him, and the best way to serve him is by taking care of his children. That's a paraphrase. I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but you think about that. That really is who we are as Americans. Our beliefs on theology and philosophy differ greatly, and that's fine. That's okay. That's why we have a First Amendment. But at our core, shouldn't that be the value that every American has? That we want to serve God, we want to worship him, and we think that the best way to do that is by helping each other out. And that's really what was at the core of the Martin Luther King speech that they gave. If you don't look up any other ad, look that one up. Go to YouTube sometime later today and look up the Martin Luther King Ram Truck ad from the Super Bowl. Fantastic ad. I thought that it was really good, really hit the nail on the head. We've got your calls in just a second, and we're going to talk a little bit more because there were a couple of other ones that I thought were interesting that I do want to mention, and I will get onto a serious note when we get to that as well. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 1:21, for to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440. And newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. And we are going to actually go to the phones here in just one second. But we have an extra special treat for you, even though it's not Thursday.
That's right.
Joe Hunk wandered into the studio, and since we were talking about Super Bowl ads, I said, why don't you stay for a second?
I'm trying to make sure that you're ready for your basketball game tonight. That's what really, I was walking in being like, all right, you good? You good for your game tonight?
Yeah, I think I'm good. I'm ready.
740 Game Room, man. The 1976 Philadelphia 76ers versus the 1994 Houston Rockets.
That's right. I'll be representing the now, I guess, Super Bowl champion city of Philadelphia. It's just
everything's
basketball.
In your favor.
Right.
Everything is in your favor, man. I mean, if you would have just worn your Chuck Taylors, you would have been set for tonight.
Although I am playing the Houston Rockets, and they won the World Series, so
it's Philadelphia and Houston. It's the battle of the last two champions.
Yeah,
there you go. If we had a Tuscaloosa team, then it would all be set.
We should put that in the promo or something. All right, let's go ahead and go to the phones. Let's go to Ben on line one. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, y'all. How you doing?
Doing good,
doing
sir.
Great.
That was a good Super Bowl game. That's the best I've seen in a while, and the halftime was really good. Justin Timberlake, I think, did a really good job. As for the crocodile or the Australian ad.
Yeah, that was great.
But get this. My son goes, the joke's on us. I go, what are you saying? He goes, there's going to be a remake, and Danny McBride will be playing his son. That's what that's what he was saying.
Oh, yeah. So it was a fake ad, but not really a fake ad?
Yeah. Joke, right. If you know Danny McBride, if you've seen his movies and stuff, that's the way he is.
Yep.
Huh.
And I had a time of my life doing the dirty dances. I was laughing my head off. That was so good.
That was by far my favorite ad.
To me, that was the perfect one. And again, it has the local connections because it had DJ Fluker, it had Landon Collins in it, and it was so good, man. It was totally out of his character.
The Martin Luther King is already getting complaints about
ripped.
That we are reducing Martin Luther King down to selling Ram trucks. Come on, people.
Didn't Chevy or Ram do this with Winston Churchill or something a few years ago?
They've done it before. Yeah.
Well, like I said, you've
got complainers. Though. You've always got somebody that's gonna.
Look, here's the truth. You mentioned the halftime show and the kid that got the selfie with Justin Timberlake and he was on Good Morning America and all this. I actually have a friend that works for the Minnesota Wild and the Minnesota Twins. And obviously she was at the game. Mm. And so she tweets out jokingly, that kid is going to be the most popular kid in school tomorrow. Just as a joke. Which honestly, we were all thinking it like, oh, this kid's going to be popular. Left-wing people, and she's retweeting this, left-wing people and civil rights people are all going, well, he's a white kid at the Super Bowl. His family's got enough money. Of course, he's probably already popular. And she's like, I was just joking around. Like, I wasn't even saying anything controversial. And you guys decide that you want to turn. And it wasn't these trolls that are like 300, 400 followers. These were people that have 15, 20, 25,000 followers that were tweeting at her about this. And I'm like, what's the big deal about something along those? Like, that's when you're just taking it too personal, man.
Well, that's the thing. Not absolutely everything has to be this righteous social justice warrior cause.
No, it is what it is, you know. I mean, come on. And it's a wonder they haven't complained about what Justin Timberlake was wearing, the camouflage, you know. Sure he was supporting the troops, you know, or he was... And, you know, a Trump supporter, I don't know. You know, people just read into things. Just let it be what it is.
Well, exactly. I've said this so many times, Ben, and I do appreciate your call. I really do think that there's a segment of the population, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but I think there is a segment of the population that wakes up every morning just looking for things to be offended by.
Look, when I watch the Super Bowl, and again, I'll be honest with you, and this is the first time that I've done this all year, and it actually, like, I hate that I did it, but it made me feel better that I did it.
Right.
I didn't watch the national anthem. I didn't watch Pink perform. I listened to it, but I didn't actually look at the TV. And the reason was I did not want to see somebody kneel. Like, again, I don't know if anybody did. I don't even know what time it is. To this very
moment,
10:30. I have no clue if anybody kneeled during the national anthem or not. But I didn't watch it just for that reason, because I didn't want to ruin my Super Bowl experience because of that. I stayed off Twitter for a good 20 to 30 minutes after the national anthem so that we could. So when I hopped on, I would just see game stuff and I would just see commercial stuff, because if it did happen, I didn't want to hear about it. I just wanted to enjoy the game.
You know, I actually saw more than one news story about people protesting the Super Bowl and not watching it who would have normally watched it because of the whole kneeling thing that went on.
Yeah.
They've been protesting the NFL all year, and they still said on the Super Bowl, no, we're standing our ground.
Well, if they were standing their ground outside of that stadium, Godspeed, man, because it was minus 3 degrees. So you really got to hate the NFL. Ooh. I mean,
when I say protesting, I don't mean protesting outside the stadium. Just not watching.
Look, if you're going to protest, you don't let the weather affect you. You stand out there for 2 and 3 hours with your signs and all that sort of stuff. That's when we know you're serious. If you were serious enough about wanting to protest the national anthem or protest the NFL, then you do it in Minneapolis during the Super Bowl when it's -3 degrees outside. Then you'll get taken seriously. If you're not doing
that's
it
true.
Then, again, if you're standing inside the Mall of America on Radio Row and you're over there at GameStop looking at video games in between times, that's not cutting it. I want you outside in the freezing cold to protest. I'll take you seriously.
Because here's the thing. If you do that, even if people completely disagree with your protest, you say, well, at least he's got dedication.
Exactly. And that was where I was watching this is in, you know, I didn't care about the commercials. Look, I love Justin Timberlake. I loved NSYNC. Again, I was in high school when all these things were huge. I mean, again, God must have spent a little bit more time on you. I could sing that thing right now at karaoke. Okay? I didn't care. But I just wanted to enjoy the football game. I was all about this game. I was all about the Patriots. I was all about the Eagles. I hate the Eagles because I'm a Cowboys fan, so I wanted to see them lose. I love Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. I wanted to watch this game and just enjoy the football aspect of it. And if I got a good commercial here or there, then great.
Well, here's
not,
a novel
no
idea.
Big deal.
And I'm speaking directly to the leadership of the NFL on this. I would say about 98% of NFL fans are coming from it from the exact same angle that you are. We just want to watch the game. No politics,
no
protest.
No.
Just let me veg out for 3 hours and enjoy a really good football game.
Let me enjoy my wings. Let me enjoy my pigs in a blanket. Let me get some chips and dip. And let me just watch a football game and enjoy it. And you know what?
I don't know anyone that watches the NFL for political commentary.
The Super Bowl is like going to a movie theater and watching the movie. You have got a window of 2 straight hours, and you've got to pick your spot when to go use the restroom. You really do.
Yeah.
Because if you like the games, but people also like the commercials, and that's fantastic. That's great. I myself, anytime I saw a movie trailer, bathroom break, I didn't want to see any movie trailers. I didn't watch the Solo one. I thought that really was a Crocodile Dundee remake commercial.
I
zoned out for it because that's what I thought it was. I didn't watch any of those commercials because anytime a movie trailer came on, the new one with The Rock, the skyscraper one,
I don't know that one. I'm an action movie guy, and I was like, I don't know about that one.
I didn't watch any of them because I don't want to like them. Now, my wife loves them because then it lets her know which one she's going to see. I already know I'm going to go watch Solo. I don't need to see the movie trailer. I already know I'm going to go watch it. So I didn't need to watch it, and so I used those as my bathroom breaks.
Well, you weren't missing much on the Solo one. It didn't show very much anyway.
I could hear it because I heard them say I'm going to be the greatest pilot ever, and what's your name? And then it goes into the music, and I'm going, okay, this is the one for Solo. Like, I get it. Okay.
Yeah.
I did watch the Westworld trailer. I did watch that one that they did, which was kind of cool on it. I didn't know, and this was honestly, I didn't know that Cloverfield Paradox, I had no clue that was a Netflix show. I thought that was a real movie. Like
The trailer made it look like a real movie.
It's on Netflix right now. Like, I saw it this morning, and I went, oh, okay, I guess I could watch that right now if I'd actually seen the first two, which I think the second one is actually on Netflix right now. But I use those to get away. The one, hands down, the best commercial to me out of the ones that I saw was Eli Manning and Odell Beckham Jr.
Hands down.
And here's the reason why. And I don't know if it's because I'm a sports guy, but because I see so many press conferences with Eli Manning, because we all know about his brother and how outgoing he is, we have always been told Eli Manning has a very dry sense of humor and he's not as outgoing as his brother. And to see him act like that.
I thought that was a good
moment
for him.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Because it showed him out of his comfort zone, and it got into that 30 to 40-year-old range of people that all remember that movie. And the best part of it had nothing to do with Eli and Odell Beckham Jr. in the last scene, him holding it up. My favorite part of that was when all the groups of people were doing the line dance that they do down the aisle when they're getting towards it.
That
hands
cracked
down,
me up, too.
Hands down, that was a favorite one. There's not even a close second one to me. Not even a close second.
No, I'd have to agree, and you weren't even here for my first segment, but that's actually the one that I said was my favorite one as well. And that's the thing. I'm not into the game, don't care about the NFL, and I still love that commercial. It was such a great commercial.
It was so much fun to see something like that and to see it go over and just universally loved by everybody. Just because, again, Eli Manning is literally the only person until last night to beat Tom Brady in the Super Bowl. And so that's what he's always going to be known for. The only Eli Manning commercial that could have been better than that one was if Eli Manning did two commercials. Okay, and I'm saying just did two commercials. Very similar to what was designed for the New England Patriots back in 2008, 2009, whenever they were going through the perfect season. Mm-hmm. The Miami Dolphins created two commercials. One where a UPS truck, I want to believe it was a UPS commercial, pulls up, and in the box, you know, it's like a Super Bowl football. And the football is like, you know, well, Patriots won, let's welcome them to the block. It was like a moving commercial, actually. It was like one of those, just welcome them to the neighborhood. They're the other perfect football team.
Right.
Well, they did a second one, which was obviously Eli Manning sending a game ball to the Dolphins saying, you're welcome. And so the whole joke was, okay, well, thank you, Eli Manning, for making sure that you beat Tom Brady, and we're still the only perfect team in the NFL history. If they could have done something off of that where it was Eli welcoming Nick Foles to the only group to beat Tom Brady, that would have been legendary. If it would have been another one of Tom Brady sending a picture of him with another ring or something, and then being like, I'm still the only one in this neighborhood, the only one to beat Tom Brady, that one would have been the only type of commercial that could have beat him doing the dirty dancing.
That might have topped it, I have to admit.
That's all I said, is if they came up with that commercial, because that would have been brilliant.
I want to mention one more commercial before I go to the break, which I thought was, I just wanted to comment on this. Did you see the Mountain Dew commercial?
I don't remember it.
It was a combination commercial with Doritos Blaze, and they had the guy from Game of Thrones.
Okay.
The short guy, Peter Dinklage, I think.
Yes.
Anyway, so he comes on, he does the Doritos, and it's like all fire themed because it's Doritos Blaze. And then they have Mountain Dew Ice, ad right after it, and it turns out the ads are actually working together. Here's my question on it, because they have Morgan Freeman on it.
Yes.
And he starts singing, and they have somebody else's voice in it. Who in their right mind hired freaking Morgan Freeman to be in a commercial and not talk? To have someone else's voice.
It's the exact same person. You know who it is? It was Pete Carroll. That's who it was. The same guy that had beast mode on the 1 yard line of the Seattle Seahawks and decided that he wanted to pass the football. That's the person that came up with that. The exact same person.
That must have been, because I couldn't figure out who's sitting around in a boardroom, you know, working on the advertisers, like, yeah, that's a good idea.
Let's do something totally different. Let's get Morgan Freeman. Yeah, Bill, that's different. But let's not have him talk. That's perfect. Let's do that. That's brilliant. No, it's not. It's stupid.
It was like when they made that Fantastic Four movie and they put Jessica Alba as the Invisible Woman. It's like, why would you put Jessica Alba in a movie and make her invisible?
She's naked and you can't see it whatsoever. Look, by the way, the person that nailed the Super Bowl commercials, the sheriff from Stranger Things, that guy was everywhere last night. In that Tide commercial, there's your number two. The Tide commercial where he's like, isn't every commercial a Tide commercial?
See, I didn't like that commercial
as much. Well, it's because it made you think. It was like, wait a second.
But I did like the Old Spice spoof of it, where he's doing the Old Spice thing.
Yes.
With the That was funny.
Well, the reason I liked that first one was mainly because I thought about it and I went, he's right. Like, everybody has clean shirts in all their commercials. Because it was one of those deep thinking ones that for the rest of the night, that's what you thought about the entire time of, wait a second, he's got a clean shirt on. This is a Tide commercial. This is a Tide commercial.
Yeah, maybe it's because of the way that I watch them, because I didn't watch it with the game. I watched it on YouTube later.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what killed it for me. I don't know.
It was so good, but, man. Because it was like, this is a bit, nope, Tide commercial. This is it, nope, Tide commercial. All right, I get you, Sheriff. I get you. Now let 11 out of the cabin, please. Let her out of the cabin.
All right, we got to go to a break. We'll be back.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com.
The Bible is a book worth more than all the other books that were ever printed. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. You can also tweet us at Tactics Radio. what was your favorite Super Bowl ad, that kind of thing. We're taking that this morning. You can give me your favorite, your least favorite, what you liked about it, what you didn't, that kind of thing. 860-1440 would be the way to do that. Wanted to mention this real quickly before I get serious, because I thought the Avengers trailer was really cool, and you guys know what a big comic book movie buff that I am. I love all the comic book movies. The Avengers trailer, I thought it was really, really cool to see the universe come together, because thus far in all the trailers and, you know, in Marvel's crafting of this movie, we've not really seen the heroes together. It's more been like teases of the heroes that might be in it and might not. But here we really got to see, you know, the joining together of Thor and Cap and Guardians of the Galaxy and all that. I thought that was really cool. The only thing I'm really bothered by is what happened to Cap's shield. I know that the shield, he lost it at the end of Civil War, but if he and Iron Man are working together again, why does he have like those, I don't know, gauntlets on now? And, you know, the whole, there was that whole thing about the shield breaking in the prophecy from Avengers 2, and I'm surprised about that, because shouldn't he have a shield in Infinity Wars? I don't know. I was just confused by the whole thing. I'm not sure exactly what is going on there, but I'm interested to see how they play that out. But one ad that bothered me was the T-Mobile ad. And for those of you who didn't see it, it's got a, it's a series of the camera just panning over to different babies. And the different babies have all different ethnicity. It shows an Asian baby. It shows a black baby. It shows a white baby. And keeps going on. And the ad reads, you can love who you want, demand fair and equal pay, and not allow where you come from to dictate where you're going. But the thing is, it did it in this kind of angry, combative tone, which was surprising to me. Because had all exactly those same words been said, but done in a different tone, I think that the average American would probably have been able to jump on board with it. But I don't know about you, but to me, it seemed like it was trying to stick a finger in the eye of people like myself, like conservatives, who, you know, believe in traditional marriage, that kind of thing, because the tone of the voice and the way it was presented was, we got to divide up sides. It's us against them. And it just came off as angry and bitter social justice warrior propaganda to me. Because had all those words, like I said, just been said a little calmer, not so much like it was trying to start a fight, I think the average person looks at that on paper, like looks at the script and what was actually said, and there's nothing they disagree with in there. I mean, we all want equal pay. We all, you know, think everybody should have an opportunity regardless of where they're from or anything like that. That's something that Americans can get on board with. That's fine. But because of the way it was presented and how angry the person sounded when they were reading it, it sounded like, let's divvy up because, you know, it's all us against them. And it ended with the caption to just kind of further this point. It ended with the caption on screen, are you with us? Again, intentionally divisive. It's saying, there's some people that don't want this, that don't like this, so let's join up. And, you know, the whole love who you want thing was kind of a big tell, because that's always a line used by the homosexual community, which is, you know, people aren't against that. I don't know of anybody that's against that, but there's a difference between, and I know that this is hard for society to separate nowadays, there is a huge difference between love and sex. You know, just because you love someone doesn't mean you have to have sex with them, and just because you have sex with someone doesn't mean that you love them. And yet they treat it as though a man wanting to have sex with a man is the ultimate display of love, or a woman with a woman, or so on and so forth. Even though we're not telling you can't love someone, we're saying that it's wrong for you to engage in that activity. But again, it bothered me that T-Mobile just made this huge political statement, or at least seemingly did. I mean, again, they didn't come right out and say it, but everything about the ad just came off as social justice warrior propaganda because of the way it was presented. And I think that that teaches us an important lesson in tone. Adjust your tone. And I say this to people on the right and the left, because people on the right have been guilty of doing this too. We need to start where we can all agree. Because this ad just implied that we need to divide up and choose sides and start fighting with each other. And I'm not an advertising guy. I know I'm a broadcasting guy, but I'm not actually in advertising. And so I don't claim to be an expert in the field. But I would think that intentionally alienating half of the country with your ad is a really stupid idea. Because the whole point of an ad is to, you know, get some PR out there, make the public aware of your product, and encourage them to buy it. And so coming out with an ad that intentionally alienates people and makes people think that they need to divide up against people in their hometown, their neighbors, their fellow citizens, that there's this you're either with us or you're against us mentality, that to me was a really stupid ad to make. And I don't understand why they would do it that way. So I do think that we could all take a lesson from that. And maybe when we're talking with our friends, our neighbors about politics or really anything else for that matter, sometimes it's important to adjust our tone and make sure that the way they're perceiving it isn't combative, isn't from the standpoint of we all need to divvy up. Sometimes, just like the Bible prescribes, and we actually ironically read this in church just the other day from the Psalms, that a calm word turns away anger. So sometimes, even if you're saying exactly the same thing, saying it with a little compassion and as though you're genuinely interested in the person that you're talking to, that goes a lot further than sometimes we may think. Chaplin's Report is next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 8:31 and 32. So Jesus was saying to those Jews who had believed him, "If you continue in my word, then you are truly disciples of mine, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free."
Hey everyone, welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. Chaplain's Report is on, and I do think that the subject matter here that we're going to be dealing with, I'm going to try to tackle a very common misconception in our society. I hear people misuse this term all the time. I'm talking about the word evangelical, because they divide Christianity up into several subsegments. And generally the one that's associated with the South, you know, generally people who would consider themselves Baptist or so on and so forth, they say, those are the evangelical Christians. And to the left, that actually translates to the radical Christians, the fundamentalist Christians, which, as far as being a fundamentalist, I've always been a fan of being a fundamentalist because I'm going back to the scriptures as they were understood right then, right there for the audience they were written to in the first century. So as far as being a fundamentalist Christian, I wear that as a badge of honor. But what the left perceives that as when you say an evangelical, because most evangelicals tend to not vote the way that they think people should vote, they see that as a radical, somebody that is a zealot that hangs on to their religion, kind of like a great description would be the way that Barack Obama described it, someone who clings on to their God and their guns. And so they really look down their nose with disdain for people who are evangelicals. But this is a huge misunderstanding. I also had a discussion with someone who considers himself a Christian not real long ago. And I asked him a question, and he had never thought about this before. He said, "Well, you know, I try to be polite and understanding," and he was kind of delving into multicultural or multiculturalism here a little bit. I think it poisoned his mind. He says, I try to respect everybody's belief, and I just keep my faith to myself. And so I said to him, I said, "Can you point to me whether an example of a person or an actual command in the Bible where it says to do that?" And I don't think anyone had ever asked him that question before. Because if you think about it, what if every Christian in history did exactly what he did? Well, there would be no Christians. Because if you don't evangelize, there are no new Christians. The only way for Christians and the Christian faith to grow, just like any other faith, if you want more Muslims, you have to teach people about Islam. If you want more Jews, you have to teach people the Torah. I mean, that's the only way that it happens. And so, one thing that is a misnomer here, and I want to go to Mark 16, 15, and 16. This is coming directly out of Jesus' mouth. And he said to them, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to all creation. He who has believed and is baptized shall be saved, but he who has disbelieved shall be condemned." That's very clear cut. You go out into the world and you convert people. You teach them the gospel. You teach it to the book of Mark there says all creation. All creation. Matthew's gospel says right after the Great Commission that Jesus will be with them until the end of the age or the world, depending on the translation you're reading there, which implies what? They're going to be going that far. Everywhere teaching the gospel. The gospel is not for this set of people or that set of people. It's not reserved for this particular group. No, the gospel is for everybody, and you teach everybody you come in contact with. That's the charge that Jesus gave his disciples. So in reality, there is no such thing as a non-evangelical Christian. That would be like saying, I'm a violent pacifist. Or I am a vegetarian that eats steak. Well, no, those two things are contradictory. You can't be a non-evangelical Christian. If you are a Christian, you share the gospel with people and you evangelize. If you do not do those things, you're not really a Christian. Because you are not a disciple of Christ. You are not living the way that Christ commanded you to live. Therefore, those two things cannot be true at the same time. You're either an evangelical Christian, which is really an oxymoron. You're just saying the same thing twice, like Jewish rabbi. Well, there are no rabbis that aren't Jewish. Ergo, if you're a rabbi, we can just assume that you're Jewish. If you are a Christian, we assume that you are evangelical because there's no such thing as one that is not evangelical. And think about this. I thought about this from Penn Jillette, who's an atheist, but a very logical, very sound guy. He said, if you saw me and there's a bus coming towards me, how much do you have to hate me to not push me out of the way of the bus? And he was talking about Christianity because he was surprised that there are so few Christians that have shared the gospel with him. Because if you really believe that his soul is in danger, doesn't that show a disdain for him if you don't say, look, I want you to be saved? And that's coming from an atheist. To be a disciple of Christ, we have to care about the souls of others. And the way that we show that and the way that we follow the example that Christ gave is to share the good news with others. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.